All right, welcome to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast of the week. Once again, we are back to talk all things persuasion with all people who are ready to be persuaded or to persuade. I'm Dr. Dan French. I'm the founder of Rhetoric Warriors, rhetoricwarriors.com, where we are out to teach 100 million Americans how to actually persuade each other. And again, that's sort of the mission statement. A lot of things go into that. We put out a lot of free content and a lot of paid courses that you can take if you want to get into more of the specific learnings about persuasion. My background, again, real quick for people who haven't tuned in before, I have a PhD in rhetoric. I taught persuasion for almost 20 years at the University of Level. It's been my life's work. I run a marketing agency with a partner called 500 Rockets Marketing. And so this is what I do. I've done consulting, I do coaching, all sorts of stuff, but it all eventually comes back down to the world of persuasion. The podcast is to sort of open things up so that it's not just me doing webinars or me doing blogs, but bringing in other voices, other perspectives. And I know a lot of cool people because I love to collect cool people and bring them into my life and eventually into my businesses. So we're going to talk today with one of the people I've collected along the way. And if you listen to any of the podcasts, you'll see that a lot of times I try to bring in people from extreme or different points of view than mine. So I just think it makes a more interesting conversation. And so this week we're going to be talking to Dan, a friend of mine for a while from Seattle. Dan is not going to be identified farther than Dan from Seattle, because as he and I have talked about, there are consequences that you don't always want to deal with when you mix politics and business or politics in your personal life. That's just, that's a raw fact and perfectly fine for people to want to avoid those clashes if they want to. So we're going to have a conversation here. I'm going to introduce Dan, let him talk about himself, and then I'm going to ask him a lot of questions and we'll go back and forth. Just to introduce Dan a little bit, Dan is a Trump voter, an avowed Trump voter. I don't really know much about Dan's politics other than that. I've known him for a long time. We've worked together, get along very well. I think he's a great guy, but he voted for Trump. And so we're going to talk about that because Dan took one of my webinars and contacted me and said, hey, would you like to hear some things about from the other side? And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. Let's do that. So everybody, welcome Dan from Seattle.
Hello, everyone. I'm glad y'all are here. And let me say, we got two Dans, so I'm sure it's going to get confusing at some point here. But anyway, I'm excited to have this kind of conversation that sounds like we're going to have, because these kinds of conversations, two people from what can appear to be polar opposite sides, you just can't find them in a civil setting. It seems like kind of at all these days. And yet, I feel like these things are, these ideas, why we hold positions and our rationale for them, I feel like they're super important to our country, to anyone, to any society. And so I'm excited to talk about whatever you want to talk about, Dan.
I want to talk about everything. That's my problem. Like I never run out of interest in things to talk about. Yeah. In politics, like I've never been particularly political myself in the past. It's not my area of study in rhetoric. I tend to study other forms of persuasion, studied a lot of entertainment and what entertainment does. Very interesting right now with politics. Essentially, you know, maybe we'll touch on some of the stuff that Trump has brought reality show politics or reality show entertainment principles into politics. Yep. First person to ever do that. Caused some major upheaval, been very interesting. But so I've never been political myself. But I think what's happened now is Trump has brought politics into almost everybody's life. So you can't really avoid it. And my stuff kind of got sucked over into that. And I found it more and more interesting and have done more and more about politics over the last couple of years. So I'll tell you what, to get us started, Dan, why don't you just sort of take us breezily through your politics and sort of where you are and how you think you got to where you are.
Yeah, absolutely. So just to kind of give you an idea of my background, I'm a white middle-aged guy. I'm professional, doctoral level degree. I live in a conservative city, and my entire, like you, I've not been super political my whole life, and we all kind of got dragged into it over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years. So I've paid more attention, but I've voted historically for presidential elections, historically Democratic.
So who does that mean? Who'd you vote for?
So I voted for Hillary in 2016. I voted for Obama twice. Actually, I voted for Obama the first time, and I voted for a libertarian candidate. I believe it was Gary Johnston.
Okay.
Johnson for Obama instead of Obama's second term. And before that, I'm pretty sure I voted for Bill Clinton. And going back further, it's getting a little foggy. But I consider myself an independent voter, just because I try to be an independent thinker, and no one side is ever going to have all the answers. And I certainly don't align myself as Republican. I consider myself to be a fiscal conservative, social liberal.
Now that's a really interesting designation. Okay. So that is literally a talking structure. It's a talking point that was invented by the right, and I think given to the left, of fiscal conservative, social liberal, right? And people
now, was that the compassionate conservative? Was that where that came from? The compassionate conservative, who was that?
Well, what you find again, sort of my approach is to always look at the language that's swirling around whatever phenomenon that you're looking at. So in politics, the language is very strong on the left, very strong on the right. And even within the libertarian middle space, it has a very strong language set. So when I hear something like that, I know has been scripted by somebody that's not you, right?
Sure. Yeah.
So you did not come up with those four words, but a lot of people use those words.
Yes. And I use them because they most closely align with how I identify myself. But yeah, you're right. Those aren't my words. I've been hunting around for the best way, you know, of my life to describe where I am at that day. And they match up the best with where I am right now.
Which is typically, I mean, that is the normative structure that we almost all live under, that we are given sets of terms and sets of ideas, and we find the ones that we like, that resonate with us, and then we adopt them.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So tell me what you think about those four words. Explain what you mean when you say those four words for you.
Sure, I'll use another little quick one-liner. And basically that means I'm left of Bernie, but I'm better at math. Left of Bernie means, I think, free healthcare, free education, even universal basic income. I mean, take care of our folks who need us the most. I'm pro gender, sexuality, LGBTQ. Basically, live and let live. Live and let live, and live within your means at the same time. So
live and let live, but you don't want to pay for it.
Well, live and let live, meaning everyone's free. Everyone's free to do whatever they want, so long as it doesn't harm others' ability to do the same. And I understand that there are going to be conflicts and overlaps there. But in general, if that's the goal, I think we end up in a good place.
Yeah, and I think that's fairly in line, at least the first part, right, with what I would consider, you know, sort of the normative American democratic structures. They've gotten moved over into liberal. You know, they've been dropped into that camp lately, but it's not always been that way. But the idea of we are all free and independent, and you can create your own life.
Yeah, yes. Fewer restrictions, except for those restrictions that make sure that we all have the ability to live as freely as we can. Like no murder, for example.
What? No stealing. That is radical.
Yes.
Are you sure? How about just a little murder?
It's out there. Well, there is a little murder allowed, actually. They just don't call it murder, right?
Really? So what is it? Tell me about killing. This. I could use some of that little murder permission.
Yes. Yes, the self-defense kind, the capital punishment kind, I'm against capital punishment. If we're going into that. I'm pro-choice, but within reason. So I think, meaning, I don't think it should be midterm. I think we're just looking for an arbitrary point at which life begins, and there's too many options there. So I think that, honestly, I would prefer to let women sort that out themselves. Because I feel like you're going to get a good balance. It's a decision mostly about women, and yes, without getting into all that, I feel like women, if we left it up to women, they could come up with probably the best solution for that particular one.
You see, I think life begins when you buy somebody a drink.
Ooh, yes.
I take it all the way back.
So you could say you're ultra conservative there.
Yeah. So there's so many arbitrary points along those continuums. And this is one of the things I find really fascinating. Like, life has gotten so complicated. Even the idea that medically, because of technology, we now know all these tiny increments in the development of a fetus, right? Ergo, we can now make some kind of micro decisions along this pathway that we never could make before.
Excellent point. These are just, it's information we didn't have. So we now have more options, which just confounds us further.
Yeah, we have a lot more information, but we're not ready to process it. Like, our brains, where human beings are, we can look at it and understand it, but we're not really, like, we've got a whole new type of information that's come to us, and we're struggling with it.
Yes, and I definitely agree with that. Yes.
So let's go back to, I get it, you're lefty in your culture.
Yeah.
You know, live and let live. That's a good set of... a good playbook there that you got, sort of let women run women things and stuff like that. We'll talk about the other side of it, the fiscally conservative.
Yeah, yeah. So honestly, I've been kind of an economics nerd for the past, ever since the global financial crisis got me really interested, because it had such a huge impact on our country and the world. I started following lots of folks and trying to teach myself about, hey, how does something like this happen? What are better ways to run a society, the economy of a society? And I've come to the conclusion that cheap money is really kind of the source of all of our economic problems. Cheap money meaning artificially low interest rates, because all that interest rates, if you get a loan for a car, the interest rate you pay is basically a measure of the amount of risk that the lender thinks they are taking, plus the time value of the money they're giving you. So if they're going to give me money for, they're going to give me 30 grand for 6 years, they're going to want to collect more total money than if they just lent it to me for a day. Because if they loan me 30 grand and I say, I'll pay it back tomorrow, well, that's not that big of, an investment for them. And so you wouldn't expect to pay much in interest. But but artificially low interest rates like we have now, set by the Federal Reserve, means that the time value of money has disappeared. And
right.
More importantly, what it means is that risk has been done away with, supposedly, because it would appear, according to the federal funds rate, that only the big banks get, by the way, only the big boys get the super low money. We pay the 20% on our credit card, but the people with all the money get the super low rates, and it encourages malinvestment because it's essentially free money.
Right. So let me ask you something. Let's wrangle this back over into the political spectrum instead of the financial spectrum, because I know what you're talking about. And I've looked at sort of the finances stuff myself a little bit. It's not, again, my area, so I very rarely use it to really expound on anything. But who do you blame for those low rates?
Oh, so it would be the formation of the Federal Reserve, and I believe it was 1913. I think
didn't the rates plummet under Bush?
Oh, they've plummeted during crises ever since.
They've never come back, now, right?
Oh, they go back up, but then if you were to see a graph of interest rates over time, and it would, the graph would start high on the left and finish low on the right. And in between those, there would be ups and downs, but the net trend is clearly, it's about a 45 degree down angle.
But isn't this a Republican thing? Like, didn't Reagan start this with supply side economics and all this kind of make money cheap and, you know, make production easier and sort of up consumption to try to, you know, keep up with it? Isn't this a Republican phenomenon and the Democrats keep inheriting it?
I honestly don't even know who started it. But what I can tell you, Dan, is that every government, no matter who's running it, uses these things. Obama had interest rates close to zero for most of his 8 years.
Yeah, I don't know like how much you've tracked it. So I'm going to take you back a little bit farther. So when I was in college, Reagan came in 1980, and I started college in 1981. Reagan came in 81, elected in 80, whatever it was. Anyway, when I started college, there was a lot of free money, a lot of free grant money. And by the time I got out and Reagan had been in office for most of his first term, I went from all grant money to all loan money.
Right.
Because he defunded education. Within this whole thing that you're talking about, which I attribute to the right, which is supply side economics, like take the interest rates low, make things really super friendly for business and let business get healthy. And then they will therefore take care of America.
Trickle down theory.
Yeah, that's the way, that's the easiest thing they threw at it. But it was literally supply side economics as far as, you know, my understanding of it. And it's essentially pro-business economics.
Right, right. And that is definitely the Republican stance.
Right. And so they also at the same time said they went after taxes. So like, we can do all this, but we've got to cut all the expenses, like all the fat, all the graft, all the cheating. We're going to cut all of that. And get rid of welfare and get away with all this free money because that's where we're losing all the money. And it just, it's a very pro-business type of finances.
Absolutely.
And you're down with that.
Oh, no, not at all. Not all of that. So here's the problem. I am down with smaller, leaner government. Absolutely.
Why is that? Now, that's another one that's a plant from sort of an extreme right perspective, like going after government as the issue. Talk to me about your feelings about that or what.
Well, I don't know if I would say extreme right. I would say on the conservative half of the spectrum, I'd agree 100%. But governments tend to do things more badly than the private sector. And that's straight up
true. I'm going to. This is part of my problem when, as a rhetorician, like those three words haunt me of, is that true? So you made a claim that, you know, free enterprise does things better than government.
Right.
Is that
so true? Well, let's look at Obamacare. That's a good health care. So what has happened since the Affordable Care Act? And I know there are a lot of variables here. I'll say that right up front. I know the Republicans have worked to stymie and gut ACA.
They've destroyed it.
Yeah.
From the very beginning, like before it even got in place, they took all the finances out underneath it so that it was going to inflate. It was going to be a problem.
Well, here's the premise. It did run as designed, as intended for most of Obama started in 2012 or something like that. So it ran for a long time, pretty much unencumbered because Democrats were in power. It wasn't until Trump got elected that he took away the individual mandate, which is really the secret to the whole thing. So the way Affordable Care Act is designed to work, the idea is if you force everyone to get health insurance right now, and I'm kind of in a healthcare industry, so I have some personal experience with this. Right now, if you're healthy, you're less likely to get health insurance, or before all this started. Healthy people don't feel the urgency to get health insurance like someone who had diabetes might.
Right.
And the problem is that if only the sick people get health insurance, then if you're a health insurance company, you're paying a lot more per patient because it's just all sick people. So ACA's idea, and I mean, I like the idea. It is, if you can force everyone to get health insurance, kind of like car insurance, right? Everyone has to have car insurance. Well, then you get a lot more healthy people in the mix, and it lowers costs across the board, like overall. for the other people. And the individual mandate is that part of it that says everyone has to get it. And if you don't, there's a penalty you have to pay. So that ran as it was designed mostly for much of Obama's presidency. And yet I still remember, my healthcare premiums through Obamacare went up every single year. And one year they went up 40%.
Yeah.
40%. Right. So I don't know. Of course you can't say, well, they would have gone up more than that if we hadn't used it. You can't prove that. But it certainly has, healthcare costs have gone up almost exponentially over this term. Now, there are many, many, many contributors, I understand. But anytime you get government as a middleman involved, there's guaranteed waste because you have to pay the government to run the thing. Whereas with private industry, there's just the creator of the product or service and the consumer. There's not the third person in the middle, which is the government, who has to pay their
right
people to be involved.
Yeah, again, just sort of let's play logic games, because you know all these things are things that we look at from sort of the bottom or the middle up, right? So this idea that if there's a middle person or a middle entity in between you and, you know, the seller, between the buyer and the seller, that prices go up. But part of the role of government, at least the way this was pitched within the ACA, is to control costs. So that's right. That's not necessarily true that prices have to go up. If the middle person or the middle entity is doing its job right, it's controlling prices.
Right. Agreed.
But none of this stuff works the way it gets sold. And that's partly because we have a competitive system always going on that's eroding the other side's approach. I have people say to me a lot of times, like, communism doesn't work. It's never worked anywhere, or socialism doesn't work. And I'm like, yeah, but like when you look what communism is supposed to be, communism exists always in opposition to capitalism and democracy, right? So it's never allowed to just be a pure system and see if it would actually work as it's, you know, theoretically designed to work. That's not the way things happen when they move over into the real world. So you can't really say communism doesn't work until you get in and find like a pure communism that didn't have to fight capitalism or all these forces, you know, that are trying to tear it apart. And that's not me. I'm not communist. But when I look at any type of theoretical set, there's always the way it's intended to work and then the way it gets forced to work once it gets into the world.
Yeah. And well, I'll let you finish your thought and I'll comment.
Well, I'm just, sort of when we go back and forth on politics, it's real easy for, so I'm going to introduce a concept here that I think it's going to be useful in our conversation. And we've maybe talked about this before when we were working together, the SPS concept, smart people syndrome. Almost everybody I work with when I do marketing and consulting and things like that are incredibly smart people, often very educated. But smart people syndrome makes you feel that because you can read and kind of understand and theorize about things, that you therefore have a grasp on them. Whereas like getting into it, like if you were actively involved in the ACA and you had been for the last 20 years, administering it, working within it, seeing what's actually working, then you would have a type of knowledge that would allow you to decimate this conversation.
Oh, absolutely.
And neither one of us have that.
Right. This is just my best interpretation of what I see happening around me. And I'm completely prepared to be totally dissuaded and with evidence to the contrary. But it's my current working understanding of what I see.
Sure. So let's go back to the big flag on the boat. So why did you vote for Trump amidst all of this?
Ah, yes. So I voted for Hillary in 2016. I was not excited about it. She seemed like just another, I've been pretty jaded by politics in general at that time, by that point. But I just thought, this Trump guy, he just seems like a loose cannon. I mean, it seems like he would bungle the job. I don't know if I want him as the figurehead. you know, representing our country to all the other countries. I mean, especially coming off Obama, who's so statesmanlike and, I mean, pretty much gaffe-free, and everyone loves him. I mean, you like having a popular, good-looking guy running the country, or a girl, I don't care who it is. But it's there's a certain amount of just feels good
sure.
to have.
Oh yeah, for
have,
sure.
Have a professional running the show. Well, but then when he won, you know, I thought, oh, this is going to be a shit show. You know what
you don't think
the
it's
hell
a shit
is?
Show?
Oh my God! Well, it's been a shit show, but it's not a one-sided shit show, in my opinion. It's been a two-sided shit show. You anyway.
Tell me about that. I want to hear that. I want to hear this depiction that. So in rhetoric, in the study of fallacies, I keep finding this. It's the dominant fallacy right now in politics, and it's the fallacy of false equivalency, which says one side does it, yeah, but the other side does it too.
Oh, the what about
everywhere.
The what aboutism, right?
Yeah, it's essentially, yeah, it's a classical rhetorical fallacy of, like you just said, both sides have culpability here.
Yes, and I completely understand that fallacy and don't want to fall into it. However, we're always going to be dealing with humans. Humans are always going to be imperfect. So really, all I should be looking for is the least imperfect, or at least the best overall of the bad choices that we have. So so to do that, I looked at both sides and continue to, and I see problems on both sides. Now, the question becomes, when it comes down crunch time and it's ready to, you know, plunk down a vote, it's which side is going to fuck things up slightly less than the other. That's literally what
that's
I mean.
A
when
cynical
I say,
view, Dan. That's
yeah, it is. It
how did
is.
You get to cynicism? You're not. You don't seem like a cynical guy. Like one of the things I really like about you is that in your occupation, you are the most optimistic, skilled, and effective person I think I've met. You know, and across the board, you're so good at actually delivering on the things that you optimistically know you can do.
Well, thanks. And I absolutely consider myself an optimist overall. Absolutely. Let's think of it as where I'm setting my expectations for our elected representatives. So I set my expectations low because of track records and history, and because I live and breathe, I observe. And so I've learned over my life not to expect too much from anyone in politics, and also learned to expect that if there's ever a chance for someone to exploit the system for their own gain, and there's little chance for repercussion, they will exploit it for their own gain 100% of the time.
Okay, let me pull you back, because I find this really to be a really vital issue amongst people right now, and especially thinking people. This cynical view of politics, like, did that apply to Obama? Do you think Obama was a failure or somehow morally corrupt or just ineffective? What is your cynical view of the Obama administration?
Yeah, so I participated in a ton of peace rallies right before Obama got elected. I really wanted him to get elected because I didn't want George Bush's war for oil, blood for oil. I was in all these peace rallies, right? So, and then we get Obama and what happened? I'm like, he's going to shut down Guantanamo. We're going to pull us out of Iraq, pull us out of Afghanistan. Nope. So as far as me getting cynical about Obama, that's the main thing. Also, where did all those peace rallies go? What happened to them? They just disappeared. The wars continued, but all of a sudden Democrats didn't care. And these are people I identify with. I identified our Democratic side as the good guys. We're the ones who care about the little guy. We're the ones sticking up against the big evil corporations and the, you know, the corporate fat cats.
Right.
That's the way I see it.
Yeah, traditional story structure about our villains and our heroes.
Yeah. And that's kind of how I was hoping the Democratic Party would be. And then it's business as usual. All the wars continue. In fact, Obama deported more people than Trump has, more foreign illegal aliens. In fact, they you know, sarcastically called him the deporter in chief. But
where did you get all that information?
What, that he deported more people than Trump?
Yeah,
it's out there. I can send you links. I'll send you links to anything you want.
So, well, again, this is kind of a, when it comes to information in our culture, right?
Where do I source?
That's a really good, you know, touchstone for rhetorical, you know, practice about asking for the source. And then people always like, I'll say, send you the link, I'll send you the video. But let's just take a look at that claim and why that claim is a fairly powerful claim. Even before you get into the evidence, the fact that he's a deporter, you know, that somehow, Barack Obama, who you have seen his character and the things that he says and all that good stuff, would somehow endorse, personally endorse, and be okay with mass deportations. Does that sound right to you?
Well, it doesn't matter how it sounds at all. I didn't bring notes for all this, but
no, and I don't want you to. You don't have to prove it to me. I'm just saying, like, does that sound right to you?
Well, it does now. It does now.
Why?
So it didn't initially. Well, it's because I've seen the numbers.
But you don't know what those numbers mean. Like, you may look at quantitative, like there's more people going out under Obama than there are under Trump. But Trump has let less people in. God knows what he's actually, you know, doing, you know, within the legal system to change this stuff. You don't know whether his numbers are correct because he bakes numbers. I'm just saying, look back, if you're judging rhetoric from ethos, which is character outwards, versus logos, which is, you know, evidence outwards, that the ethos evidence of Barack Obama is that he had strong compassion, caring, rationality, reasonableness as baked into his ethos. He was going for that.
Well, my cynical side would say, that's definitely the portrayal of himself that he was trying to make. I assume this is me speculating, but any politician portray the best ones, I would argue are simply best at telling you the thing you want to hear, whether it's what they actually believe or will do or are doing. I feel like lying is baked into politics, and some do it better and some lie to us in such a way that we thank them for it.
Now, okay, there's another nice rhetorical claim. This is why I really enjoy these conversations, is because I hear all these things that have been planted in you as very good, reasonable, smart guy thoughts, right? But that's not what rhetoric does. Rhetoric doesn't think within smart guy normal looks at the world. So what you just said about all politicians lie is, again, a false equivalency. It's an untrue statement.
So wait, let me just understand you. Are you saying that there are politicians who don't lie?
Even a
sizable chunk of that.
Well, let's take it apart a little bit so we can actually be operative within the language and the logic. What do you mean by lie?
Tell them it's an intentional untruth for the purpose of, well, I guess it kind of doesn't matter the purpose. We could take it that far if we wanted to, but yeah, to accomplish their ends.
Well, yeah, I mean, a lie is basically just an untruth, right? It's something that is at some level, to some degree. So there are 1% lies, like 99% of what you say is true, and then 1% of it is wrong. And it can be intentional or unintentional. Usually if it's a lie, then it's an intentional untruth versus a mistake.
I agree.
So if Obama was a 99% truth teller, and had 1% sneak in because of mistake or because it was more useful for him, you can't make an equivalency to Trump, who's like the other way around, 1% truth, 99% falsity.
I agree 100%. The only problem is, how would any of us know that he's a 99% truth teller?
Well, then you go back to things like, again, what I was talking about, the difference between ethos and logos. ethos is you know how to judge character as a human being. It doesn't mean you're great at it or you're always right, but you have good basic instincts about what makes a person a certain type of person. And with Obama, he certainly seems like a good dude.
I agree. He seems like a good dude. He does.
And do you trust your instincts enough to say, yeah, that's a good dude? Or is it your cynical side that says, I don't have trust in politicians from a logical perspective to ever believe anything that they show about themselves or say about themselves?
I'll say not cynicism, skepticism. Skepticism is, I want to believe as many true things and as few false things as possible. So if there's to that end, I look at the evidence we have, and granted, it's not complete, and it's always, we have to assume that the good evidence is going to be amplified about a person by that person or group, and the bad evidence is going to be kind of downplayed or misrepresented.
Right. That is how the human beings talk.
Yeah. So we have to assume that that's happening everywhere in politics. I care about the things that I have reasonable confidence about. Well, I care about them all, but I would, oops, I lost you, Dan. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Okay.
Yep.
I lost image here.
Oh no.
Guess it doesn't matter. Yeah. Yeah. So, for example, the things that I do know about Obama that, again, not saying he's bad overall, but made me less enamored with him as a leader, are the fact that he made no effort to stop wars. In fact, he added a couple of his own. And I'm an anti-war, anti-interventionalist person. I think we kill way too many people as a country. And I think if you follow the money as to who benefits, the qui bono idea, I think is a good way to at least guesstimate that a lot of these things are being done, these atrocities in some cases are being done for personal gain.
Awesome. That is, again, a beautiful piece of cynicism. And I'm not even disagreeing with it. You know, I'm working class, so I distrust the entire infrastructure of the rich and the corporate and the government. So it's very easy for me to tag into that, right? But one of the things I'm trying to do, like with you, is I'm very curious, like let's pull it out of Obama and back over to Trump.
Sure.
So if you could have voted for Obama again in 2016, would you have voted for Obama again or Trump?
No, I didn't vote for Obama his second term. I voted Libertarian.
Because he didn't change enough things? He didn't follow through with the things that you thought he was going to do?
Yeah, yeah.
Isn't that because he was blocked by the rightist government?
Oh, I totally understand that, you know, a president can only do so much. But presidents are now allowed to get people into wars, and they can get people out of them. I mean, Trump's doing that right now. He's pulling us out of Syria, pulling us out of Afghanistan and Iraq. In fact, that's some news today.
Yeah, he's pulling us out. The question is whether that leads to worse conflicts down the road.
Well, and of course, that's the narrative, right? That's sure. The narrative of the left. And so far, what was your original question? Bring it back to Trump. So what were you asking?
I was asking, like, so I want to get back into your thoughts about Trump, because which we haven't really gotten to yet, because I keep pulling you back into the history of it. I said, like, if you could choose from Obama again, or maybe even a Libertarian candidate, you voted for Trump this year. You didn't vote for him in 2016.
Correct.
But you voted for him in this past election.
Yes, I did.
So talk to me about that, because from my side, from the left, when they look at Trump, they see a complete dangerous shit show.
Right.
How could you vote, you know, within that context? And I'm not saying that's true or not, but like, what do you see when you see Trump?
Well, let me answer your question by asking you a quick question. Like, what's the number one, what is, say, the number one thing about Trump that you feel makes him dangerous?
Well, from a rhetorical perspective, a lot. Like, he uses across the board very unethical persuasion techniques. So, for example, slander. Oh. He just is a slander machine.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. And now, unethical and effective. So,
well,
I feel like
that's,
you might
those
agree.
Are very different conversations. So for me, it's unethical is the issue. Like, if you shoot somebody in the head in the middle of the night, you know, that's your competition, then you effectively eliminated them. But we typically say that's not allowed.
Absolutely. So I feel like, for me, it's a matter of separating the person and how I feel about the person versus the job that they are doing. And I could choose the person who I feel is more ethical and statesmanlike and puts a better face on our country, or is more generally well liked or loved. Or there's a situation where I might choose someone who's a complete, you know, dumpster fire, but who happens to be able to accomplish some things that I really think are valuable for us as a country. So if we end up better off as a country with an asshole leading it, I'm going to choose what's better off. I'm going to choose the asshole.
Okay. Perfectly rational statement. Makes absolute sense. Let's look at it a little bit. So you're saying, and again, that kind of separating Trump out, like, this is another thing rhetorically that was done within the last couple of years. And I think to reach out to people like you, for people who are generally not extreme right, you know, sort of hyper vigorous defenders of Trump, versus like people who are just conservative. They want the country to be more conservative. And one of the things about conservativeness is you do the things that you say you're going to do, right?
Right.
That's a principle within conservatism. That's
I would think that all across the spectrum of political ideologies, that everyone would respect that. Respect someone who does what they say.
Typically, yeah. I mean, that's something that we typically like, you know, as human beings, definitely as a culture, that you say it and you do it. That's, you're good for your word, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That kind of stuff. So let's see. So that the first thing rhetorically is you've separated out his actions and who he is as a person. So if he was just number six, or if he was a talking puppet up there and you never saw Trump at all, you'd be happy with what he's done as a president.
I would be generally happy. And and of course we're guessing what the alternative would give us. Right. So in this case, it's basically Biden. I'll say it's basically Kamala Harris. It's what we're really talking about. So who would do the better job, Kamala Harris or Trump?
Okay, you just put a little rhetorical magic on me with switching Kamala in there.
Well, I mean, if I had to bet money, and I actually have bet money on how long Joe Biden will last in presidency, assuming that it's all settled out in his favor. I would bet he doesn't last a year. He's going to step down and Kamala will step up.
All right. Well, you heard it here from Dan from Seattle, who just,
that's right.
I like it. You're like Babe Ruth calling his shot. It's like right
there.
Yes.
Left center field, baby.
But okay. I like that. Let's table that. So I don't get it. I want you to get a chance to talk about your feelings or your decisions about Trump. So talk
basically
about that.
We're guessing what we would get with the alternative, right? Sure. So we've got this flawed, clearly flawed human being. And yet the world has not ended. Now, you would think it's ended, or you would think it's going to end at any second by turning on the news, right? So every word that comes out of his mouth is pitched as, this is exactly what Hitler would say, or look, he's going to become Hitler. Well, we've had 4 years He hasn't deported anyone. He hasn't killed any families of terrorists. All the things that he was accused of, he's been accused of. Is there anything he has not been accused of, right? And everyone was convinced, for example, that he had all these shady dealings. He had, he was Putin's puppet. I mean, how many times have we heard that? An agent of Russia, all these things. And yet, yeah, none of that stuff has come to pass. And here in the United States, we call that not guilty. So
cool. Great statements. But you made a ton of claims in there and conclusions.
Right.
Let's take Putin.
Okay.
The not guilty with Putin, I posted about this on the blog last week. You can't put the criminal or the person on trial in charge of the trial. Like, where would you ever do that? And like, if you had any type of criminal proceeding, like, well, the judge has to answer to the guy being accused.
Clearly not. So explain what you mean. How is Donald Trump in charge of that trial?
Because he was in charge of the Department of Justice that was investigating him.
Who was clearly on his side. All those leaks out of the DOJ that were all against Donald Trump. I mean, do you feel, I'll ask you, if the DOJ was in Trump's pocket, would they be leaking nonstop bad info about him that often turned out to be untrue, or at least out of contextually untrue? If the DOJ, if the FBI, if the CIA,
I don't know. Like, yeah, I get what you're saying. Like, so we're looking around for evidence to try to prove some of these sub claims, right? He fired, Comey, he picked Barr. And since then, Barr has done a ton of stuff that's very pro Donald Trump. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he is the employee of Donald Trump.
But that's not how the system's supposed to go.
Well, he serves at the pleasure of the president. So what do you mean exactly?
Well, I'm saying, like, take it out of that context and say somebody's accused of a crime. They get to hire the investigator that's investigating them and limit the investigation. That would never be done. And then okay, say, oh, so yeah, that's a good verdict.
Okay. So is our country set up to do things differently than the way that they were done? I mean, did Trump subvert the legal system or the, I guess I'm just asking, was this our country's system of government prevented from working the way it was designed to work by Donald Trump?
Well, one of the interesting things I think about Trump and the far right in general, one of my explanations for them, again, from a rhetoric perspective, is that they've gone in and found the flaws in the original Democratic Code. All the honor system stuff, all the norms and the ways of typically doing things. The right, and this started, again, I think pretty much with Gingrich when he came in the mid-80s with the Contract for America. The right discovered that if they just break all the norms, all the honor system, they don't compromise, they don't bring bills to the floor if they have the power to stop them, they block over and over again, that they can lock up government and get a lot more power because there's no way around them.
Isn't that inevitable in any system that eventually everyone will figure out how the system can be exploited to their benefit and then do so?
Yeah, but that's, again, a false equivalency. So what we're talking about is the normative democracy that grew up in America over, the last 250 years. And what's now happened, and one of my base positions is that our normative democracy, it has been invaded. It's an invasive species. It's a different way of doing government to come in and find all the flaws, all the weaknesses, and just exploit them. Anybody could have done that along the way, but we never have because it destroys democracy. You can't run a democracy if one side is breaking all the norms. And that's essentially what Trump has done. he's broken the norms of the judicial system. Like, he has invaded the judicial system with the executive side, and he's put pressure on it. He's fired people right and left if they don't do what he wants, yada, yada, yada.
So none of the things you're describing are illegal. He has the right to hire and fire people. In fact, that's his, you should say it's his job to hire and fire people.
No, I'm not saying they're illegal. I'm saying they're breaking the norms, the honor system. The honor system isn't legal or not. It's an honor system.
Well, but yet we are now and have always had the constraints of the Constitution with the checks and balances built therein. And I believe that our framers considered all, you know, as many of the risks. I think they did a brilliant job considering all the risks of one person, like executive branch, running away with things and taking control. So the fact that our government runs so sluggishly and takes forever to do things, I think is part of the reason that no one can run away with the whole thing. And like it or not, it's the system we have. And as I forget who it was that once said, democracy is the worst government system in the world, except for all the others.
Yeah, they're all flawed for sure. But so what I'm trying, one of the things I do in Rhetoric Warriors is try to get people to lift themselves out of the linguistic structures that they're trapped in, because everybody gets trapped in linguistic structures. So if we just take the idea of democracy, right, move it over to democracy 2.0, say we're going to improve the next iteration of democracy. How do we do that? You know, versus democracy, and then we're going to erode it and create some type of, you know, what Cheney and those guys and Scalia set up as the much stronger executive.
I'll tell you exactly what I'd want to do to change it. Campaign finance reform.
Great. There we go. Just take all the money out of it.
Yeah, because that's the thing that perverts everything. Basically, the campaign donations and all these, the lobbyists working, that's just fucking legal bribes. That's the way I see it. It's just legal bribes. So that's the way, that is what has perverted our republic, which is not even a democracy. It's a republic. And at that, the money has perverted things. And of course it's pay to play. And I think we shouldn't be surprised that we're getting what we have.
Yeah,
so that would be top of my list.
That's great. Yeah, I think so. When you look at, you know, this idea of democracy 2.0, that we're going to fix democracy so it runs much better. Like, even the thing you said earlier, like, it really bothered you that you see all this great energy of people protesting for peace, and then nobody getting into the presidency and pushing for peace.
Right.
Awesome complaint.
It's the same thing as happened with the. With the pussy hat protests on inauguration day. So with Trump. So I was in one of those protests in 2016. Yeah, I mean, I went and joined the crowds. It was fun. My mom was there. But it was not a women's right thing after all. It was an anti-Trump protest, just like the anti-war protests I thought I was in. We're just anti-Bush protests. So, and again, those things just kind of like melt away as soon as the new thing, well, the anti-Trump stuff didn't melt away by any stretch, but.
I agree with you. I think that's true. And I think one of the reasons why, again, when we get back into the problems in modern culture, like, I disagree. I don't think the constitutional founders had any clue how to build a constitutional document that would fit 2020 America. It's such a disjuncture between that document and what we have right now. Like, we need a constitution 2.0 as well. So, like, just the thing you pulled out about democracy work better if we got all the money out of the elections.
Yep. Great. And also, I think the Supreme Court should stay at a set number. And I also think that if possible, it should be as close to a 50-50 split, like 5-4, with both parties, because I don't like that we have a Republican or at least conservative majority in the Supreme Court. I don't like that, because then you get the same kind of thing. You get the court politicized, and it just becomes another arm of the political part side of things. And same thing would happen if we pack the court. We can look to other countries who have packed the court with extra. Each time they win, they just appoint more judges, and you end up with like 150 justices. And it's, you know, it's it, all it is just a rubber stamp for whoever's in power.
So yeah, I would be careful. Like I think that's all that's true. Like this is the interesting thing I think about democracies is that they're malleable. You know, there's so many changes that you can make within them. There's so many things that you can do to adjust them. And I think, again, the cynical view gets to be where, well, no matter what you do, it doesn't work. And
well,
I don't
it can always work better, even though it can not work better than it was the old system. So everything is a matter of degrees. And I'm never, I mean, expecting perfection is stupid, obviously. But improving on what we got is not only rational, but should be all of our goal. And in fact, I feel like that's what both sides of this huge divided country want. They want a better country to live in. So I think we have a lot more in common than we all think.
I think it's an interesting, so again, these things get so complicated, right? There's so many things to talk about.
each little thing could be its own hour.
What's that?
Each little subtopic we're talking about could be its own separate hour. Like, don't even get me started on journalism. Journalism is one of my biggest reasons that I voted for Trump, by the way.
See, that's amazing to me. We got maybe 5 minutes left. Let me just hit you on that just a little bit. Like I said earlier, I tend to use rhetorical structures to analyze who I'm going to vote for. I usually vote for the nicest person, by the way. But when you look at Trump as a slanderer, the main thing that he slandered to start is the press, is the media, just a nonstop slander.
Yeah.
Why would you vote for somebody that does that?
Well, does it matter whether what he said about the press was true or not? Does that matter?
Yeah, we can clearly dig into that. But what he said about the press was not true. Like it may have elements of truth in it. Like, and I have this discussion a lot with people trying to sort of get them up a little more up to speed on the idea of subjective versus objective reality, and that everything has a standpoint. There are not two sides to the news. There are 500 sides to the news, but that doesn't mean they're all equivalent, you know, like sure. what journalism, what it's taught is to seek objective reality, not that it sells perfect objective reality.
Sure. But it's the pursuit of it. It's the sincere pursuit of it that I want to see.
Exactly. So yeah. Trump has slandered the news in the sloppy, ugly way. And it's done, you know, purposefully so that he has a foil, a straw man, and another fallacy in rhetoric. And it's stuck because he just repeats it over and over again. So well, apparently it's stuck in you.
The problem... Well, now, what if, again, I'll go back to, what if the things he said, the nasty things he said about the press, what if he said a really nasty thing about the press and it happened to be true, what he said? Would that make a difference that it was said in a nasty way and yet was true?
It makes a difference that he's nasty, period. He's a president.
Yeah. Yes. But does that absolve the press of the thing that was true that was bad about them?
So you got to tell me what you think that he has said about the press that is true. Because he has said about the press is true.
Ooh.
It has an element of truth that he blows into this massive bullshit scale.
Now, I'll agree 100% that he uses a lot of, to put it mildly, hyperbole. And I'll say that absolutely. So I don't like his I don't like his blunt technique either. I don't. Just for the record. But like the fine people hoax, the Charlottesville. You remember the Charlottesville situation where you had, So, and Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, just this week, still repeating it, even though it's been debunked, that he called neo-Nazis and white supremacists fine people.
Right.
And when in fact, that was the exact opposite of what he said. The exact opposite. But you would never know that because if you were in the news silo of the six major news providers, ABC, NBC, CBS, PBS, whatever they are, because they just repeat it uncritically. And it's a contextual lie because what he said, and you can let me know if you knew this already or not, but that same interview where he was, where he said there were fine people on both sides, he said, obviously, I'm not talking about the white supremacists and the neo-Nazis. Clearly, they need to be denounced completely. That's literally what he said. Now, what do? The news, they clipped off that part and they just ran over and over and over.
Okay, so let's.
There were fine people on both sides.
Let's jump into this one again. We just have. I want to get us finished up, so I don't take too much of your time. But let's jump into that one because it's another one of those junctures, like you said. You could talk for an hour about it. All right. So this claim that they doctored the news to make him look far worse than he is.
In fact, the opposite of what he said.
Okay. So that's a claim. They doctored the news to make him look far more racist than he is. Easy for him to debunk that. Easy for him to come out the next day and say, look, here's what I said originally. And here's the way it was done. And what I understand, you got a clip somewhere, but I totally denounced this. And if he had said that 10 times every day for the next week, it'd been completely gone away. I would argue that they did capture exactly how he feels. And even if the video it wasn't doctored, it was edited. All video is edited. Can't show everything. That they captured exactly what Donald Trump actually feels, which is, he is a racist, he is white supremacist, and he supports those groups.
Well, isn't that mind reading though, since he explicitly said, not obviously I'm not talking about.
No, super easy for him to say that again, to revisit it, completely wipe it out. Nobody just jumps up and says Trump is a racist for no reason.
Well, they say it for a reason, and one of those reasons is because they've been shown this clip out of context, and the clip is being described as Donald Trump calling white supremacists fine people.
Yeah, that's one clip, but we've got 5 years of evidence now, and he's been in the public eye forever. Like, if he was not, and he wanted to clearly prove he was not supportive of those groups, it'd be very easy for him to do it.
Do you know how many times he has denounced specifically white supremacists and neo-Nazis since 2007?
No. So what we're doing now, like, this is one of those things, like, rhetorically, I tell people that when you talk to Trumpites, especially, and people that get their information like this from the media or the social media, that you're going to get into what I call a squid nest. So you end up with all these different tentacles of evidence and claims and where it comes from and that kind of stuff. And you get lost inside of the squid nest of logos. Go back to ethos, which is his character. So Trump's character, not evidence of his character, but his character. One of the things he's been labeled as a racist, and he knows this. And so if he wanted to disprove that, he could do it, but he hasn't.
So therefore, he's a racist?
No, that's not the only conclusion, but you can say, therefore, he seems a lot more racist than he needs to, and it doesn't seem to bother him that much.
Yes, and I agree. That bugs the fucking hell out of me, Dan. I wished, especially in this last debate, I wished he had just said, dude, you haven't done your research. Just go look at that clip.
Yeah, you keep pulling back to that clip. That clip is pretty powerful for you for some reason.
Well, only because it gets repeated over and over by the left. That's the only reason I care about it.
Yeah, but if that clip didn't exist, if that specific clip didn't exist, they could still make all these racist claims about Trump.
oh, people do make lots of racist claims about Trump.
Yeah, and they pull up evidence that either gets validated or invalidated. That's why I say it's a squid nest. When you get pulled into evidence and everybody starts pulling out their clips, you know, and things like that, then you're lost. You can't do good persuasion work with people. A lot of times I pull people back to ethos because it's a little clearer. Like controlling your own character is fairly easy in public at a certain level, especially the non, you know, like, you know how to not seem racist, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
We all do. We all gotten very good at it especially as white males.
And he clearly does not care about coddling or reassuring anyone.
He doesn't care about whether people think he's a racist.
I think he does because he has said it 38 times, and most of those have been in the last 4 years. He said it clearly 38 times. Now, if I had
that
guess,
number, well, who's been counting this stuff for you, Dan?
Well, you can just Google it, and there's a video compilation that I can send you right now that has him denouncing.
No, don't send me your squid. I don't want to see your squid.
Okay, but nonetheless, you mention his character. Now, we're just making assumptions about his character.
Yeah, because we're good at that as human beings.
Yes. So, well, except for 70 million Americans are really bad. So half the country is really bad at it, apparently.
Yeah.
Or they're all racists.
No, that's not. They're not. It's not that they're racist either. So they're, again, big issues when you start getting into why people voted for Donald Trump. So one of the ones you've pulled out, and this has been great, man. You're fun to talk to. You're mostly reasonable.
Hey, let's do this again too, if you want. I'm open.
And, you know, you've pulled out one that you feel like he's been misrepresented by the media as being more racist than he is.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I wouldn't, just to be clear, if I thought Donald Trump was racist, I would have never in a million years voted for him. Never in a million years.
It's fascinating because everybody on the left who looks at Donald Trump and listens to him talk is convinced that he's a racist.
Well, where are they hearing him talk, Dan? They're listening to their news silo.
They're watching him in a million different places. You don't just get him through the news silo. You listen to him, his tweets. He gets himself out in everything.
Yes, if we look at the huge majority of the population, they are not on Twitter. They are not on Twitter. You know that most of their news they're getting is all, it's mostly by TV, or it's from these news outlets or radio. And if they're listening to their, you know, if they're not listening to some alternative sources, which is what I do, I have three main silos I listen to. Because if you only listen to
what do you listen
side,
to? Tell me real quick, because I'm gonna leave it with this, but I kind of predict them, but go ahead.
I listen to NPR anytime in the car. So, and I have for decades. NPR is one of my big sources for the left. And I feel like it's a good cross section. I don't listen to Fox News, but I do follow certain commentators from Fox. I follow some independent journalists like Glenn Greenwald, Caitlin Johnstone, Aaron Maté, Matt Taibbi. These are who I think are some great independent thinkers. In other words, they are willing to consider things outside of their side and call out their own side for things, even though they still are on their side. And that's what I strive to do is to be willing to criticize my own side, even though I may still be on it, and be willing to switch sides if at some point maintaining my side becomes untenable. So that's all I'm trying to do as I go through life is find the closest to truth I can, and in government, pick the people who are going to get me the closest to what I think a good country would be. Understanding I'm going to get tons of bullshit along the way for no matter who I choose.
Yeah. So I think that's a good, like I said, you come across as a really good moral person, trying to make good decisions, trying to find good information. I would be very interested to sort of take more of that apart from position of, again, rhetoric. What has been done to you that you're not aware of?
Yeah.
Because it's fascinating. The things that you say are all still fairly programmatic according to different rhetorics that have been built and absorbed by, again, really smart people. And this is why I ended up in rhetoric, because it's the blueprint underneath how you think. And it offers you the chance of pulling back and saying, okay, this idea of exposing myself, just for example, to multiple sources and choosing the ones that I find valid, and then, you know, using a lot of their thoughts to try to understand things that ultimately you have no experience with. Like, neither you or I have ever been with Donald Trump. We've never heard him talk about other races. We have zero actual expertise about any of it. And here we are trying to make this a good conversation about whether it's true or not. And that's crazy. Right. That's a crazy idea to try to do.
And yet we have to. And yet we have to.
Well, one of the again, things that you get to with the idea of democracy 2.0 is this whole idea that you can run a democracy on faulty information is a very flawed idea. And so it becomes a challenge.
But how do you ensure accurate information? Because I think that's an impossibility.
You take Rhetoric Warriors courses and they teach you, they teach you about epistemology and the investigation of knowledge and information. And maybe you get a little more sophisticated in it, which ultimately is the only thing I've got to offer, right? Like, I've been studying, you know, this stuff from academic perspectives and then yanking it back over into the real world for coming on 40 years. That's what I've done for a living. And I see a lot of times most of our culture has not been trained to that stuff. So we really struggle to get to good, clean air when we come into these situations and we're trying to discuss this stuff and get to a good position, because we don't have a lot of the tools that we should have. So again, that is the idea behind sort of the program. And just to sort of finish up, anybody can go and take the course. I've got a master course, Persuasion Treasure Trove, where I hit every strong concept I know and try to cover that in a year. And then we're going to have individual courses that I'm building right now and getting ready to release here fairly soon about, like, how to convert people that are Trumpers or MAGA or extreme right, or even just moderate conservatives. Because for liberals, if you're on a liberal side, then that's what you need to be looking for. It's not about expressing your views. It's about listening to the other side, understanding why they've made their decisions, and then seeing what you can do to help them over to the decisions you want them to make. Like, I don't approach this, Dan, to try to convert you. There are things I would do differently if I were. But it's fascinating to me, like, that first stage of just hearing and just listening to what, you know, is circulating around people's heads. And so thanks for being my first guest on this particular version of the podcast. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Dan. I'm happy to come back anytime. We can, journalism might be the thing I would be most excited to talk about with you next, if you want, but that's totally up to you.
Yeah. Like I said, I love talking about all these things. It's endless. There's so many trails to go down.
It is. Yes, indeed.
And I was trained as a journalist, by the way. My undergraduate degree was in journalism. I worked in journalism for a while. So it's fascinating to know it from that side and then see what's coming at it right now and these huge tsunamis of people that are now, you know, activated about the media because Trump, you know, has just attacked it so much that people are actually thinking about it. It's interesting.
I think that's actually a really good thing that's come out of all this kind of chaotic upheaval is that people are taking more of an interest. I hope it's a good thing. That people are taking more of an interest and being a little more critical in their thinking, because I think too much. Yeah, I think that we've been a little too complacent and willing to just accept whatever is we're told as being accurate, when in fact everyone has an agenda.
Totally agree, man. Good stuff. So I appreciate it. Enjoy the conversation. And I will see everybody soon again on the Rhetoric Warriors podcast.
Thanks, Dan. Have a good night.
Thanks, Dan.
Bye.